teeth is loose. Worst of all, she tried snatching the blaster rifle on the way past, but it spun out of her grip as the guards fired on her. And then, out of the gloom, comes one ray of light. She heads through a door and finds her way forward. A sky bridge leads out to the landing platforms. The platforms fill the distance, topping tall towers along the shore. Beneath them wait sand and stone and sea. Leaving this planet won't be easy. And at this point, she's sure there will be some kind of blockade in orbit. They'll be combing every mote of stardust for a sign of her. And if they capture her, they'll throw her in a lightless pit. She will never again see her empire, and Rax will be left to kick it farther into hell. But she has to try. If she leaves now, she may be able to seize on the chaos. They'll still be looking for her here, not there. She hurries across the skybridge, pulling off her imperial gray jacket as she runs, revealing the white undershirt beneath. The wind takes the jacket as she reaches the end of the bridge. It flutters away. A voice, then, carried on the wind. Someone calls for her. Adia? A foolish moment as she turns and looks to see who it is. It's that woman again. That damnable pilot. Nora something or other. Nora has the rifle. She fires. Sloane turns to run as the first bolt flashes past her ear. She can hear the hiss crackle as it goes by. The second digs a furrow out of the ground. The third blast doesn't miss. Her back arches as the shot takes her. Sloane spins like a child's top. The clouds above her, then the sea, and then she's falling off the skybridge. Her arms out, her fingers searching the sky for something to hold, but finding nothing at all. Darkness draws her down, down, down. Chapter 39. Morning comes to Kashyyyk. Jazz sits at the top of the world, her legs dangling off a platform, her feet swinging like a child's as she scoops some kind of goop out of a bowl with her bare hands and into her mouth. A Wookiee breakfast, Solo said. Made of kabatha guts. She asked him just what a kabatha was, and his response,
"Don't ask, just eat."
So she eats. Jazz is used to eating whatever she can get her hands on. The job being the job, it means she can't always get her mouth around a proper meal. Protein cubes, polystarch, veg meat, whatever she can eat, she eats. Once she ate barnacles off the side of a Hachi farmer's spelt silo. Behind her, Wookiees move and work and settle in. They waste no time, those big rugs. They climb the rocher like it's no feat at all. They dig their claws into the wood and move like lightning, traveling up and down the bark. They jump from branches, they duck in and out of knotholes. They swing from one tree to the next. It's quite a thing to behold. Once in a while, she looks down to remind herself how far up she's come. The ground isn't even visible from here. It's hidden beneath the mist. Mist that, right now, blazes with the fire of the morning sun. She hears Solo. He's talking to Leia, to Chewie, and she considers getting up and joining them. Then, someone plunks down next to her. Sinjir. He scoots to the edge, then pulls back.
Mother of moons! Why are you sitting here? Why are you eating that?
Why do you still have that mustache?
I quite like it.
It looks like an animal laid down to die on your lip.
You're really too blunt for your own good, you know.
She winks, then keeps eating. The ex-imperial settles in next to her, though not so close that his legs drape over the edge.
You staying?
He asks her.
Here? No.
The Wookiees have been liberated from their inhibitor chips. and the three Star Destroyers bombing the planet have been put out of commission. One destroyed utterly. But the Imperials here will still have some fight in them. Dozens of settlements dot the surface, and smaller outposts mark the margins. Even now, Chewbacca is prepping teams of Wookiees to survey the damage and the Imperial holdouts.
"Solo and Leia are staying for a time," Sinjir says.
"They are invested. I'm not. We did the job. Now the job is over."
"We did good, you know."
"I know.
It feels good to have done good."
"I know that, too."
He leans in, eyes narrowed to suspicious lines.
"So why do I get the sense that you're holding back on me?"
"I'm not holding anything back."
But his scrutiny picks her apart, like a child plucking the legs off a beetle.
"Fine. I'm holding something back."
"Spit it out."
"But I'm eating it,"
she says around a mouthful of goop.
"Not the food, the secret thing."
"Oh."
She swallows. It's like pushing a clod of wet concrete down her throat. Jazz smacks her lips a few times before saying,
"I'm leaving."
"Leaving what?"
"The team. The crew, whatever you call us."
"You're breaking up the band?"
He tisks.
"I am breaking up the band."
He sighs.
"I was thinking about doing the same, honestly."
"Why?"
"Oh, you first, Imari."
"I have to get back to work."
"And the job calls?"
"My debts call."
Not even my debts, she thinks. Sugi's. And the deal with Rinskar haunts her suddenly.
"They'll want my head if I don't pay. I've been away from that too long. I'll see if the NR has jobs. If not, someone will. It's a zoo out there. And someone needs to catch the animals."
"If you'll still work for the NR, why not just stay with Nora?"
Jazz shrugs.
"She has her husband, her son. I feel like if she keeps doing what she's doing, then it'll be more of this."
She sweeps her arms to encompass not just the planet of Kashyyyk, but also what they did here. Liberation with no cost to anyone but themselves.
"And less of the get paid for work business. If the NR won't have me, the scum and villainy of the world is still thick with rivalries. I'll get paid one way or the other."
"I'll miss you."
"Don't be mawkish. It doesn't suit you. Your turn. Why leave?"
"I feel good about what we did."
"That's an odd answer."
"Well, I want to keep the feeling. I don't want to complicate it. If I stay with this fancy new government, eventually they're going to want me to do things I'm trying not to do. I'm quite frankly tired of following orders."
"Fear."
She arches an eyebrow.
"What then? Travel the space lanes? Having adventures? Settle down with your boy toy and a couple of poor birds as pets?"
"Both. Neither."
Another sigh.
I really don't know."
"You are Takask Volask Tidan, a man without a star."
"Oh, please. Some old saying."
"Go on, tell me what it means."
"My aunt used to say it. She ran a crew of her own. And whenever she had to replace someone, or use someone for one purpose or another, she always said she looked for Takask Walas Tidan. A man without a star. Someone without a home. Without purpose."
"That's depressing."
"But is it true?"
He harumphs, then idly twists his mustache. She bats his hand away from it, and he frowns.
"You could come with me,"
she says.
"Turns out I could use a man without a star."
"I would make an excellent bounty hunter."
"Don't get cocky."
"That's like telling the rain not to fall."
He puts his hands behind his head
and lies back. I would join you, but I don't think your calling is my calling either. Maybe my calling is drunken but lovable rake. Possibly handsome chandral and layabout. Charming house husband, worthless but for his chiseled cheekbones and his whiplash wit.
Try it on. See if it fits.
I may.
He sits back up.
Is this goodbye, then? Are you leaving right from here? Or can I expect a ride?
I'll head back to Chandrila. I'm sure everyone will be all...
She makes a face.
Warm and fuzzy in the aftermath of Liberation Day. So if you want one last ride in the Halo, I'm offering. We can tell Nora together.
Thank you, magnanimous bounty hunter.
What about your boy toy?
Sinjir gestures unsubtly with his head toward the commando, John Burrell, working one platform away, helping pack up thermal detonators in a harness sling.
I think he came back to Iridiru for you and you alone.
Broke rank and everything.
We have to be done. We had fun. That has to be it. I need this bone to make a clean break. It'll heal faster that way. For him or for you?
She asks herself. She sneers.
I don't want some stray trailing after me. I don't owe him. He made his choices, and now I'm making mine.
I really will miss you.
Fine. I will miss you too.
He leans his head on her shoulder. He knows why she's come over, so he just gets it out of the way. Jom doesn't even finish bolting shut the detonator box, and he says over his shoulder,
I know you've come to let me down gently.
I don't do anything gently,
Jazz says. He can't tell if her tone is playful or not. He turns and grabs a leaf fiber rag, wiping his hands on it before tucking its corner in his pocket.
I want to tell you first that you were right.
I know.
Do you even know about what?
She shrugs.
I'm right about everything.
Keep telling yourself that, Amari.
He laughs.
No. You were right that I came to Irudiru chasing you. Then I came here and we fought. And they took me and they took my eye.
I don't owe you that. Don't put that on me.
He shakes his head.
I'm not. That's the point. I stayed because it's the right thing. I gave up my eye because it's the right thing.
Jom leans in now. She sees that he's aged over this trip. Dark shadows cross his face. He looks weathered, like wind-whipped leather. But he grins just the same.
And you stayed because it's the right thing, too. You're a better person than you think, Jazz Amari.
Don't make me kill you, Jom.
All this is me saying, I get it. We're done. It's good. I'm staying behind with the Wookiees. See if I can't help them.
Good luck, Jom.
You too. I'll see you later, bounty hunter.
Leia knows she should worry. After all, here she is on a world not her own. A world still with one leg in an Imperial trap, and she's pregnant. Her back hurts, she's hungry all the time. What if something goes wrong? She knows she should be worried, and yet she isn't. In fact, the only thing that worries her is just how little worry she has. She feels good, happy even. She has Yvonne standing by. She has Han. She has her baby boy growing inside her. The Wookiees have their world back. Almost, at least. And she's here because she listened to Luke. He told her to let go. To let the Force flow through her. She did. She's here. All is well. Chewie comes up behind Han again, growling playfully as he gives her husband a big, lung-crushing hug. Solo winces and pulls away, laughing.
You big lug. I know, we did it.
She's never seen Chewie so happy. He has family here. Family they intend to help him find. And then she wonders, will he stay? Now that the Wookiee has his home, will he remain behind on Kashyyyk? Han seems to think so. He told her last night as they slept under the stars.
He has his family, and we'll have ours.
The Wookiee gurgles and lopes off toward Karatha, where they're loading crates into a handful of stolen LAIT ships. Then they'll take them from city to city, settlement to settlement, assessing the Imperial presence as they go. Leia told Han that she could maybe call in the New Republic, and he said, proud as a cockbird,
we don't need them.
Maybe, she thinks. He's right. But then Wedge hobbles over, followed by Yvonne. Yvonne tells her,
Princess, you have to see this.
Wedge takes her to a transceiver and patches in a holonet feed.
It's then she watches the Liberation Day events unfold in Hana City. The liberated rebels turning on their rescuers. The Chancellor shot. Others, too. Medine, Agate, Hostis Idge. Some still alive. Others dead.
The data coming in tells a confusing story with conflicting reports. Chaos has seized the capital. That much is clear.
Leia's heart breaks as she watches. Further, she can't help but feel that if she had stayed, she might have been one of those dead.
Or maybe she could have helped stop it. A choice too late to make, with consequences that will forever remain unseen.
Just the same,
the Empire did this. That much she knows.
A hand falls on her shoulder. Her husband's. He stands behind her, shell-shocked.
We rescued those people. I don't understand.
He visibly swallows. It's rare to see him rattled. This has done it.
I have to go back.
It takes him a moment to find his focus. But soon, he's looking at her with clear eyes. He nods and says,
I know.
I don't want to. I want to stay here, with you, with Chewie.
I know that, too. But I have to go, too. I have to come home.
You could stay here. I'd understand. Help Chewie.
Chewie's got this. He and the others have hard work ahead of them. Our part is over, Leia. I want to be by your side through this. Whatever this is. And whoever did this, they'll pay.
I'm going to go prep the Falcon, she says.
I won't be far behind. I have to say goodbye first.
She cups his cheek, then kisses him. Sadness shines in her eyes. Not sadness for her, but sadness for him. Because this will be hard for him. She knows that.
He won't admit it.
But saying goodbye might kill him.
Leia lets her hand linger on his face, and then she's gone, heading toward their ships with Wedge in tow. Chewie is there with Karatha, picking up crates that it would take three of Han to lift. The Wookiee is as strong as these trees. Sometimes it feels like he's damn near as tall, too. It doesn't take long for his co-pilot to see him there. Chewie and he have always been in sync. Okay, sure, sometimes Chewie goes one way and Han goes another. But they always meet on the other side of things. And at the end of every day, what needs to get done damn well gets done. They're partners. Have been for most of the life that Han can, or cares to, remember. Chewie grunts and growls.
You're doing fine, you big lunk.
Another growl. This one a question.
Wow. This is harder than he thought.
Han scuffs a heel and throws up his hands like he's folding at the sabacc table.
I thought this day would come later, Chewie. But something's happened, and...
The Wookiee steps up and nods, mumbling a soft response. Chewie understands. Even before Han says it, Chewie gets it. In sync yet again, to no one's surprise. Chewie knows that Han has to go. And what's the first thing that the gargantuan hair beast does? The Wookiee offers to come along right now. Han waves both hands and shakes his head as vigorously as he can, even waggling his finger up in his friend's shaggy face.
No, no! You have to stay here. We fought like hell for this, and now this is yours. Okay? All yours. This is home. You got people here, and I want you to find them. You hear me? That's my last demand. No arguments.
Chewie rumbles, but Han reiterates more firmly this time.
I said no arguments. You be with your family. I have to go start mine.
A moment of silence stretches out between them, and deep in the space between Han's heart and his gut, he wants to seize on the desire that lives there. He wants to tell Chewie...
Just kidding. Let's go, pal. Get on board the ship and let's see what trouble we can cook up.
Then they'll race off together to Malastair or Warren Station or back to that dusty Mos Eisley cantina to pick up some other wayward dust farmer kid. And then when he gets home and his baby, his son, is born, Chewie will be right there doing whatever needs doing because that's who Chewie is. But he doesn't say any of that. Chewie hugs him and purrs.
I'll be back. We're not done, you and I. We'll see each other again. I'm gonna be a father. And no way my kid won't have you in his life.
One more bark and yip as Chewie pets his head.
Yeah, pal. I know.
He sighs.
I love you too.
Chapter 40. This is nowhere. At least not anywhere Sloane can identify. Out there is the consumptive void of space. No planets, no space stations, no other ships. Nothing and nowhere. The little cargo ship is the only thing out here. Sloane cuts the engines. It drifts. The ship could be her tomb, she realizes. Every breath she pulls through her chest feels like she's inhaling broken glass. At least the bleeding has stopped. As she shifts in her seat, her pants peel away with a crackle as the tacky seal of dried blood breaks. Survive. Fight. Get Rax. She ponders opening a calm channel. In her head, she conjures a message to Rax, a bitter threat that tells him she's coming for him, even though truly she's dying here in the void. He will always be forced to look over his shoulder in case she might be sneaking up behind him with a whetted blade. It would be a wonderful curse to pass along, a small castigation sent preemptively from beyond the grave. Her finger hovers over the button. Sloane's mind is muddy. She thinks instead to go find medical help. Certainly she deserves survival. But where would she go? She fears the Empire has now fallen fully into the betrayer's hands, and anywhere else might earn her a one-way ticket back to Chandrila. Because by now, she suspects the word is out for her capture. She imagines her face up on a bunch of holo posters like a common criminal. What a crass indignity. No, she has to wait. She sent out her message. She made her play. She can't get to the junk moon on her own, but someone else can. Wait. The realization slowly comes to her that she is not alone on this ship. That is a mad, impossible thought. It is clearly her body dying, The toxins are running laps through her now. She's hallucinating. And yet, she feels someone's gaze boring into the back of her head. Paranoid, she turns around. A man is standing there. Pale, mussed-up hair. He has a blaster. A small graphene blaster.
"Get off my ship,"
she murmurs, her words a smeary mess.
"You did this to me,"
the man says.
"Put you on a cargo ship in the middle of nowhere?"
She barks a mirthless laugh.
"Hardly. How did you get here?"
"I saw your uniform. I followed you to get answers."
"Why announce yourself now?"
"Because I wanted to see what you were doing."
Her chin dips.
"You won't find any answers from me."
"You turned me into a monster!"
Sloane blinks. He looks familiar.
"You are one of them."
She doesn't have to explain to him what that means. One of the captives turned murderers. A traitor made by the Empire. Not her Empire, though.
"Yes,"
the man trembles.
"And you're going to pay for it."
"I'd rather not, since it's not me that did this to you. The blame falls squarely on someone else's shoulders."
Her words slur together.
"I don't even know what happened there. I was set up. Same as you."
"Not the same as me!"
The man screams and fires the blaster. She doesn't flinch. Her mind is slow, her body hurting, and the shot comes and goes before she even realizes what happened. The bolt scores the steel above her head. She blinks.
"You missed."
"If you didn't do this, who did?"
"A man named Gallius Rax. At least that's the name he gives. You want whoever did this to you? Go have at him."
Her eyelids flutter as her chin dips.
"Leave me in peace."
"You know him. You can help me."
"I look like I can help anybody. Can't even help myself."
"You're hurt."
She rolls her eyes.
"You don't say. Idiot."
The man seems personally upset by that. Thin-skinned, this one.
"You haven't even touched the med kit under your seat."
"Med kit? What? Under the..."
Her hand brutishly paws the space beneath her chair. Sure enough, she feels something.
"Oh.
Who's the idiot now?"
he chides.
"Still can't save me. Got shot."
The stranger grumbles, then tucks the blaster in his waist before hunkering down and pulling out the kit. He pops it open with both thumbs and draws out something that looks like a wide-mouthed scatter blaster. Still grousing, he pulls out a wad of what looks like gray hull putty, shoving it unceremoniously into the mouth of the weapon.
"Hold still," he says. "This may hurt."
"What are you?"
He grabs her hard, crams the device right into her wound. The gun shudders, and then the pain hits like a comet. Hot and terrible. It burns her up from the inside, and she can't breathe. All she can manage is a howling gasp as she doubles over, trying hard not to weep. Unconsciousness takes her with its teeth. Eventually, it lets her go again. And when she awakens, she's on the floor of the ship, on her side. A puddle of drool pools underneath her.
"Whoa."
"Back to Patch Gun,"
the man says, sitting in the co-pilot's chair.
"Healing web epoxy. The Rebellion used it from time to time. We got covert training on how to stay alive to fight longer. The stuff is inside, mending what can be mended. Eventually, you'll have to get to a real doctor. It isn't a perfect fix."
She feels like someone punched all her insides. But she also feels clearer. And when she takes a breath, it doesn't feel like needles stuck in her lung meat. Well, that's something.
Thank you, I suppose.
He points the blaster at her.
Now, take me to this Rax.
If only it were that easy. I can't just push one of these buttons and make him appear. He's not a hologram.
Oh, really? He might as well be.
Getting to him will be a long con.
Let's get started.
She shrugs.
It's not that easy. I'm waiting for information.
I know. I heard you make the call. Who is Mercurial Swift?
Bounty hunter I work with sometimes. Tell me, though, what's your name?
It's... The rebel hesitates. Brenton.
I'm Sloan.
They wait like that for a while, talking here and there, mostly just sitting in silence. Comes a point when she starts to fade out, and then when she startles awake, Brenton is right next to her, damn near face to face. She's about to grab for him, but he says, "Incoming comm!"
It's him. Mercurial.
He appears above the dash, a blue ghost rising from nowhere. A cocky tilt to his stance.
Sloan?
Tell me,
she hisses.
You're pushy.
I'm paying to be pushy.
You know Imperial credits are damn near worthless, right? Might as well be plasto chits traded during a game of Pazok.
Through her teeth, she says,
then I'll pay you back in favors. 10 favors. 100. A whole Star Destroyer back to the walls with favors.
And here she almost loses it. Almost starts coughing. But she bites it back and holds her tongue. This stranger on board her ship has already seen her be weak. Mercurial will not be afforded the same luxury.
Now, did you get to Quan Chi? Did you find the ship?
The hologram hesitates.
I did.
And?
Amita was right. He had droids. I had a slicer take a look.
Did you find anything on Rax? Anything at all?
Mercurial nods.
I did.
Tell me!
Infinite favors, you say?
He doesn't give her a chance to confirm.
Your friend is from a world in the western reaches, right at the edge of unknown space. Jakku. I'll uplink the coordinates.
The drive console dings. A map shows on the screen, charting the hyperspace path through to Jakku. It's all she needs. So she finishes up with,
good. I owe you.
Then she ends the transmission. She sets a course for Jakku. The Ravager launches through hyperspace. Those gathered around the table with Gallius Rax at its head know where the Super Star Destroyer is headed. And as yet, none of them are quite sure why. They give each other furtive looks. Obdur looks to Hux. Hux looks to Borum. Only Rand keeps his eyes forward. A sign of civility, loyalty, and fear. Rax appreciates that.
By now you know that our precious Grand Admiral is lost to us, Rax says. He shakes his head and clucks his tongue. We will, of course, make every effort to get her back from the clutches of the New Republic, should we discover that she is alive. Thankfully, she is well trained in resisting interrogation. We have no expectation that she will give up the location of the fleet. She will be true to us.
It's Hux that speaks. He's agitated when he says,
she knew. She knew what would happen. Are you saying Grand Admiral Sloan was in on it all?
Of course. I only advised her on this plan, but the plan was hers all along. Hers is an incisive mind, and the loss of that mind leaves us in the lurch, doesn't it?
Together the men nod.
As such, it is vital we preserve her vision of the Empire, and we need to preserve her leadership and the vision that directed her leadership.
Rax pauses, letting his words hang in the air.
Are you claiming the mantle of Emperor?
Borum asks.
Rax hmms. I think not. I'm not worthy.
Grand Admiral, then?
No. I am far too humble for such mighty titles. As I am the advisor to this group and to the Empire at large, I shall take for myself the title of Counselor to the Empire, serving as an interstitial leader only until Grand Admiral Sloane returns to us.
This is unprecedented!
Borum blusters.
Of course the old man would be the one to protest. Age brings stubbornness.
Age diminishes vision.
Counselor is not a title in our record, and it leaves us effectively leaderless.
Our record must evolve, much as the Empire must evolve,
Rex says sharply. Too sharply, he fears. He must maintain the illusion. He must lead his men to the conclusion he seeks, not the conclusion they want or expect.
Again, I expect this to be a temporary title.
Borum again.
As temporary as the Emperor's title when he ceased to be Chancellor of a lost republic.
At that, Rax smirks.
Perhaps.
And why Jakku?
The General is pressing his luck.
Jakku is a wasteland. It has no strategic value to us. No resources, no populace to enslave. It has...
It will be our proving ground, Rax says. We will test ourselves on Jakku, and we will do so far from the eyes of the galaxy, far from the eyes of Mon Mothma and her sycophants. And when the time is right, when we have whetted ourselves to a vicious point, we will strike once again. The Senate is injured. The Republic is wounded. We will go in for the kill. But it is too soon, and we are too weak.
In their eyes, the firelight of uncertainty and fear. That is fine. He needs them only so long. All of them but Hux. Hux will be necessary.
Chapter 41.
The aftermath of Liberation Day is like a slow, concussive wave. It ripples through the New Republic in the weeks after the assassinations. It has only been a few days, but this is what they know. Grand Admiral Sloane is gone. She fell off the skybridge, but then landed on another. All that they found of her was a streak of blood, and later her jacket all the way down on the shoreline, caught in some fisher droid's net. The theory on Sloane is that she escaped in a small cargo ship, a Chandrillan HHG-42 bulk star, docked close to where she fell. It took off not long after Nora and the Imperial finished their fight. The final clue is that the ship never made it to any of the Chandrillan colonies. It escaped through the blockade above the planet, seizing the chaos and its cleared colony codes as a likely opportunity. Brenton is gone too. Where, none can say. They have not found him. Not alive, not dead. He is a ghost. Once more banished to the void. Many are dead. Those liberated from Ashmead's lock had weapons. Small, concealable graphene blasters that remained shielded from detection. Those pistols held only a handful of shots, but each was lethal. It seems that the dissemination of the pistols comes down to the efforts of a single guardsman. A man with blonde hair and a little scar. A Chandrillan man named Wyndham Traducier. With those weapons, the turned captives fired into the crowd. Citizens were injured and murdered. They killed members of the New Republic government, too. Maedhin is rumored to be dead. So is Hostis Idge. As are senators, diplomats, and military higher-ups. Algate is alive, but her face requires reconstructive surgery. The Chancellor is alive, too. Her injury is serious, but she's awake and aware. The doctors expect her to make a full recovery, though every day she's injured is another day the New Republic looks weak and its future uncertain. Nora was told she will receive another medal for saving Mon Mothma's life. They said that her action against her own husband helped divert the blast meant for the Chancellor. Nora ensured the blast only struck the New Republic leader in the shoulder, not in the chest or the head. Nora does not want the medal. No, she wants something else. Temin crashes the X-Wing. It skims along the Silver Sea, going low to avoid sensor arrays. But he goes too low, and he's not paying attention to his proximity alarms. The tip of one of the S-foil wings dips into the sea, hissing and sending up a wave of spray. That spray cools the engines just as he's coming in way too fast. The starfighter's nose dips and twists, and next thing Temin knows, the ship is tumbling end over end, pieces breaking off, the cockpit cracking above him as the ship rolls into the water and sinks. Everything goes dark.
Wedge drags him out of the simulator.
"Another ship down," Wedge says.
The disappointment in his voice is as plain as it is on his face.
"Not like it's a real ship, since you'll only let me in the simulator," Temin says, popping his knuckles nervously.
He stomps off and sits down on the bench against the wall. The other line of simulators sits unused.
"I told you, Snap. We can't put you in a fighter right now. Because of who I am. It's not just that. Things are locked down right now, kid. The bureaucratic belt just got a little tighter, is all. If you score well on the simulator, and maybe don't crash your fighters every time, we can get you back in a ship before the next moon alignment."
"Great! My father tries to kill the Chancellor, and suddenly nobody trusts me."
Temin pauses.
"Actually, when I say it out loud like that, it kind of makes sense."
He sighs.
"Whatever. Things okay with your mother?"
The way Wedge is asking, the way he asks every day, in fact, makes Temin think there's something going on he doesn't understand. It's now, right now, that he considers the possibility. Does Wedge Antilles have a thing for his mom?
"What the hell? That can't be right."
He makes a face like he just licked a leaky battery.
"Ugh, that's gross. So gross."
And yet, at least Wedge isn't an Imperial assassin. So that's something.
"Dad."
Familiar rage roars inside of Temin like a firing engine. It won't stop. It won't leave him alone. He closes his eyes at night, and there it is. Anger at his father. Bottomless well. Brenton Wexley. Supposed rebel hero turned, what, Imperial sympathizer? Drone and soldier for the evil Empire? They've been questioning the former prisoners, the ones who turned into assassins, and it's like they're lost, confused, or stonewalling. Almost like they don't realize what they did. Temin tries to hang on to that, clinging to the thought that maybe Brenton didn't know what he was doing. Temin's knuckles are already scabbed over from where he punched the locker a week ago. He wants to do it again. And he almost hauls back and slams his fist into the wall. But with Wedge here, he has to restrain himself. So he does. Instead, he thinks about something else. Something better.
I never said it, but good job, Kashyyyk. That wasn't me. That was Leia. I don't know. I heard you coming in there with Phantom Squadron was pretty slagging amazing. Wish I could have seen it. Instead of being here and seeing my father up on that stage pointing a blaster at Mon Mothma.
Wedge putting together Phantom Squadron like that, out of a bunch of washouts and weirdos, was a thing of genius. That's why Temin wants to join.
I did what Leia needed me to do. She led the way.
And from what Temin hears, it cost her political capital, too. Whatever political capital means. Wedge adds,
"Hey, watch your mouth, will you?
I don't want your mom thinking you're picking up that kind of language from me. Sure, Dad. Whatever you say.
He sighs.
I'll get the next flight right. Put me back in the sim, right now. Let's do this.
He's itching to do something. Get his mind off everything.
You sure?
Temin is about to answer hell yes, but next to him on the bench, Wedge's holoscreen lights up. Temin can see what it says. It's a message from Nora. His mother wants him to come home ASAP. He arches an eyebrow to Wedge.
Do I have to? Sorry, Snap. You better. Like I said, I don't want your mother mad at me. You can try the sim tomorrow. And hey, miracle of miracles, maybe you won't crash the fighter next time. Yeah. I'll see you, Wedge.
Better get home. See what Mom wants. The door to the interrogation room hisses open.
Guardsman Wyndham Traducier.
The man looks up when his name is spoken. The shock of blonde atop his head is mashed flat. He sneers in the half-dark.
You.
Sinjir nods, then sits.
Me.
The ex-Imperial loyalty officer has come to interrogate me,
the traitorous guardsman says, lips still curled in a cold smirk. The man tries to lean back, but the cuffs bound to an eye ring in the center of the table prevent him from moving too far.
Good luck.
Sinjir's nostrils flare with a long sigh. A coldness has settled into his bones, his skin, his mind. When he and Jazz learned the news of what had happened here in their absence, her response, as was the response of so many, was anger. Rage, burning hot like a puddle of hyperfuel, spilled on the ground and set aflame. Sinjir's anger was not hot. It was cold. An icicle stuck into the meat of his heart. Perhaps what he felt could not even be best described as anger. Rather, what he felt was disappointment. Disappointment that the galaxy confirmed for him its worst self. His deepest suspicions about how all things are broken and unfixable were suddenly given evidence. But it clarified things for him, too. Things about the galaxy, about the New Republic, and about where he really belongs and who he really is.
I have not come to interrogate you, Sinjir says.
Oh, really? The New Republic didn't send you?
They did not. I do not work for them. I paid the guard to let me in here. Interrogating you would do no one any good at this point. You've already given up what information you have. As I understand it, the New Republic Security Bureau did find your secret second apartment, and that tells quite a story. They know that you distributed the weapons of assassination. They know that you planted a transponder on the top of the Hana City Opera House, and that the transponder rebroadcast a scrambled Imperial signal to little inorganic biochips, undetectable slivers embedded in the brainstem of each of the Ashmead's Lock prisoners. They know that it was you who killed Julius Shale and Arson Crassus, and also that you helped Duke Tashu escape.
Sinjir leans forward and lowers his voice.
I'd ask you why, but I don't care. I don't care about any of this.
Then why come at all? Why have me brought to this room? Don't you want to hear my reasons? Don't you want to hear how I believe the New Republic is a hobbling, crippled thing at the outset? How the Republic will allow chaos to take hold in the vacuum of control? How...
Shh, Sinjir says, thrusting a finger against his own lips.
You stupid little man. Let me tell you my reasons for being here. I no longer care about the state of the galaxy. I no longer give three damns about the Empire, or the New Republic, or whatever else comes rolling along when those both fade away. What I care about are the people I have in my life. I care about my friends.
He shrugs and stands up. He moves to the corner of the room, where a cam remains fixed to the wall. As he speaks, he covers the cam with a small silken handkerchief. I've never had friends before. I had no idea how that felt. It's rather overwhelming to feel for people like that, to care about them.
It's almost disgusting, frankly.
It's like I can't control it. But I don't want to control it. Not anymore. I'm all in.
This is boring me. Would you get to the point?
Sinjir sits back down. Perhaps you're too insipid to understand what I'm getting at. So let me lay it out for you, traitor. He enunciates the following words comically, as if he's speaking to a daft child whose brain is parasite-riddled. You made my friend sad, and that makes me mad. From behind, he pulls a vibro-knife. Sinjir flicks it on. It hums. The blade is small, but it is long enough. The guardsman starts to protest. Sinjir cuts that protest short as he plunges the thrumming blade deep into the man's sternum. Any words the guardsman planned on uttering are lost underneath a gassy, throat-clogged hiss. When Sinjir retracts the blade, the guardsman slumps forward, dead. With that done, he leaves the room.
Jazz checks the board at the New Republic Security Bureau. Everything here is in disarray, as it has been for weeks. The investigation into the assassination has taken priority, and that means the whole building is like a kicked-over red jacket hive. Doesn't help that the NRSB is completely nascent. Hadn't been operating for a full month when the Liberation Day atrocity hit. They were unprepared. They remain unprepared. The board is empty. No jobs. The officer behind the blast glass tells her,
Focus has shifted. We're not looking for bounty hunters right now. Sorry, hon.
Jazz gets it. She knew the day would come. Bounty hunters are thought to be scum. The Republic has a major public relations muck-up on its hands right now. Already a number of systems on the verge of sending a senator to claim a Senate seat have withdrawn since Liberation Day. There's talk of moving the Senate from Chandrilla to another, better protected system. And already there's talk of an independent systems alliance forming in the margins. Not Empire, but not Republic either. Hiring bounty hunters will just make the new Republic look weak. Even though Jazz damn well knows that hiring bounty hunters is a very good way to get things done. They don't need her? Fine. Someone will. Time to head off-world, then. But where? Buccaneer's Den? Kanata's Castle? Ord Mantell might be her best bet. She has contacts there. Contacts who won't sell her out for the debts she owes. Of course, she's also heard of several smaller pirate states out there in the Outer Rim, taking advantage of the Empire's absence to establish a foothold. She leaves the office and considers her options when her comm crackles. A familiar voice reaches her ears. It's Nora, and she wants to see Jazz. Well, can't hurt.
Nora Wexley has been trying to get a hold of you,
Condor says as Sinjir enters their apartment.
You all right?
It's a loaded question. Condor knows that Sinjir is most certainly not all right. Whatever bliss the two of them possessed prior to Liberation Day has dissolved like a sandcastle under siege by the sea. Stress has throttled them both. Condor's been off working freelance for the NRSB, doing whatever investigatory slicer work they have around. The work is plenty thanks to a recommendation from Leia herself. It also means they have him as the slicer trying to hack the little controller chips they found in the brainstems of each of the Ashmead's lock assassins. That in an effort to figure out who made them and how they work. As such, Condor's barely been around. And Sinjir has only been around. sitting here with naught to do but pace and ponder and plot. So when Ponder asks the question, Sinjir wonders if it's wise to give the real answer. But he's tired of pretending otherwise.
I'm both better now than I was and worse,
he says. What he does not say is, I killed a man because he upset my friends, which only confirms for him what he's long suspected and irresponsibly denied. Sinjir is not a good person. He is a bad man with a talent for bad things. Condor comes over and takes Sinjir's hand. Condor's hands are warm. Sinjir's are cold.
It'll be okay,
Condor promises, but it is a promise he cannot know. He's sweet and optimistic. Translated, naive as a wandering waif. Sinjir decides in that moment. He leans forward and kisses Condor hard, and then tells him, I'm not the man for you, Condor Kyle. I am a moral weather vane spinning in this hurricane. You need a nicer breed of man than I. He thinks, I love you, but that doesn't matter. Yet those words never make it to his lips. All he does is leave. It feels almost normal, them meeting like this inside the moth. It's Sinjir and Jazz, Temin and Mr. Bones. They share hugs and small words, and though it's only been a few weeks since they've seen one another, it feels like it's been forever. So much has happened. So much has changed. Nora cuts right to the heart of it.
I regret dragging the rest of you away, too. And you're under no obligation to say yes to this.
Yes,
Sinjir says rather abruptly. Nora arches an eyebrow.
You don't even know what I'm asking.
And I don't care. The answer is still yes.
Temin claps Sinjir on the shoulder, grinning. Jazz hesitates.
I told you, Nora. I can't do this anymore. I have debts. It's time I deal with them before they deal with me.
I know, and you can say no. But please understand, I'm only asking for one last mission.
What is the mission?
Jazz asks.
Who is our target? I assume that's what this is. Another hunt and find?
Nora slides a small black disc across the table. She taps the side, and a holoviz projects above it. The frozen image of Admiral Ray Sloan from the security cams on Liberation Day. The hologram rotates slowly. All stare at it, wide-eyed.
We've missed her twice now. That makes us responsible for what happened.
Nora shuts her eyes and draws a deep breath.
No, it makes me responsible. But I don't think I can do this alone. I will if I have to.
You don't, so stop, Sinjir says.
Temin adds,
if anybody knows where Dad is, it's her. I'm in.
I enjoy evisceration,
Bones offers ever so helpfully.
I too am along on this foolish adventure.
Jazz rolls her eyes.
I'm guessing there's no money in this. A small ragtag crew of miscreants and deviants going after one of the highest-ranking Imperial figures cannot possibly be sanctioned by the New Republic, can it?
No,
Nora says.
But you have my support,
Leia says, stepping on board the ship.
Sorry I'm late, Nora.
She steps up, hands unconsciously holding her growing belly.
The New Republic wouldn't touch this mission with a catchpole, but I will. I have resources. I will use them to help you. Just the same, I cannot promise some grand payday either. My actions at Kashyyyk have made me something of a political pariah. The New Republic is no longer offering bounties, and I don't have the political capital to make it so. But this is necessary work, and I will do what I can to help you do it. There it is,
Nora says.
We aim for the biggest star in all the sky. We capture her if possible.
And if that's not possible,
Temin asks. Nora doesn't say. She doesn't have to say.
Fine,
Jazz says.
I mean too. All right, crew. One last mission. Let's go catch ourselves an admiral.
Chapter 42.
No wonder Sloan had no idea what the planet Jakku was. It lies at the margins of the western reaches. Flung so far into the galaxy, she's not really sure if they're even in the galaxy anymore. The system is close to unknown space. The uncharted end of the galaxy, beyond which lurk terrible nebula storms and gravity wells. Those who have tried to traverse the space outside the galaxy have never returned. Though distorted, half-missing communications have come back. Messages warning of geomagnetic anomalies and slashing plasma winds. They take the cargo ship down to the ground. The world that awaits is a desolate, dead place. Sand and stone and bleach scour skies. They set down not far from a rust pan outpost near a wide-open salt plain. She and Brenton walk. Sloan grimaces and feels at her side. Her hand comes away damp with fresh red. Just a few dabs of it. I'll be fine, she thinks. She hopes. The sun scorches them. The air is dry as bone dust. They head into the outpost, and she nods toward... Well, it's not a cantina. It's too primitive to deserve that name. It's mostly a bar cobbled together out of soldered scrap underneath some bent and pitted roof. An unshaven man with a grease streak across his forehead stands behind the bar, pouring something chunky into a glass for a skull-headed alien whose species is unknown to her. The man turns toward her.
I don't know you.
I don't know you either, she says.
Natiwasha Tojalijawa,
the skullhead says. The man behind the bar shakes his head.
Yeah, I know. I'm not really from around here either. Job's a job, Gaswin.
To Sloan and Brenton, he says,
I got knockback nectar if you want some. That'll be 10 credits apiece or 1/4 portion from the Orkun hub.
I don't want to drink.
Then we don't have anything to talk about,
the bartender says. What's your name?
Don't see how that's any of your business. But it's Ballast. Corwin Ballast. And you are?
Sloan hesitates. She summons a name like a ghost. Adia. Adia Wright.
Great to meet you,
he says, clearly not meaning it.
Again, I sell drinks here. So if that's not what you want...
This is a bar. Bars are usually excellent places to get information.
Oh, you want information? Here's some. The planet you are on is called Jakku. Nothing is here. Everyone on this world is a ghost. If you're here, you might be a ghost too. Anything more detailed than that, you'll have to wait till Urgo's on shift. I'm newish, so sorry.
We're looking for someone.
They're probably not here.
Gaius Rax. Or Gally. Or Rax. Or...
That lady, I don't know.
But then, his words drift off as his gaze turns to the space above her head. Up, up, up. Suddenly, a long shadow falls over them, like a sword-shaped cloud passing in front of the sun.
No, he whispers.
Brenton gasps. Sloan turns, and she too gasps. Up above, a super star destroyer has come out of hyperspace, tearing the sky open like a slicing blade. The Ravager, she thinks. All around it, other ships begin to jump in one by one. Star destroyers, mostly, manifesting out of nothing. Dozens of them. More than she commanded. Which can only mean these are the hidden fleets. the ones concealed across the nebulae.
She came to Jakku looking for Gallius Rax. It looks like Rax has come home,
and he has brought the whole empire, her empire, and her ship with him. The bartender's face goes white as he says rather solemnly,
"War has come to Jakku."
Epilogue. 3 decades ago.
Gally is cold and hungry. He has hidden on this ship for long, too long. It seems to be leeching the heat from him, and his stomach growls so loud, he's sure the whole galaxy can hear it. He tries to summon spit to his mouth in order to force it down and stop his stomach from rumbling. When that fails, he pinches the skin of his sallow, thin belly and pushes it in, until finally it goes quiet once more. Time passes. The ship moves until it doesn't. Up and around and then back down again. Gally is tough. He will not weep. Even though he is alone and he is frightened, he tucks himself between boxes, making himself small, small like a skitter mouse. Soon, a sound. Footsteps. Fabric dragging. It's him, he thinks. The man in the purple robe and the strange hat. A voice from somewhere close.
"Boy, show yourself."
That is not the voice of the man in the strange hat. This voice has a crisp accent, but it's guttural, drawn out. In it is a grim vibration that chills the boy's blood. The boy swallows hard, then stands up and steps out from between the boxes. The voice beckons him.
"Come."
It is a summoning, and in that single word is more than just a request. It has gravity to it, like it's pulling him willfully closer. The boy resists it. He plants his feet and presses his knees hard against the steel floor of the ship. Gally tightens his jaw. The man makes a sound, a grunt of what may be amusement.
"I'll not ask again."
Menace presents in that sentence, like a sword dangling just overhead. But this time, no compulsion pulls him. It is a request. A threatening one, but it is a request, nevertheless. And so the boy steps forward, skirting alongside the boxes to face a man in robes, yes, but these are not the purple robes of the other one. These robes are black as night, darker than the ship all around. The boy shuffles from side to side so that his front always faces the robed figure. The man turns toward him. From under the hood, the boy gets a glimpse of an older face, pale as a moon and just as craggy. Lines lay drawn in the skin, like clay etched by a bent knife blade. A smile stretches there.
"Your name, boy?"
"Gally is what they call me."
The boy licks his lips with his dry tongue. It makes a rasping sound.
"Are you an anchorite?"
"Of a sort."
"Are you the Aramite? Come back."
But that question the man does not answer. Instead, he says,
"You come from that world, Jakku."
"I do."
"This is my ship, the Imperialis. You are a stowaway."
"I am."
"Brave little boy. Naughty and nasty, too. Good boys do not stow away on unfamiliar vessels. But I have little interest in goodness."
The man leans in close.
"Gally, I have a proposal for you. It is fortuitous that you should find me here. Would you like to hear my offer, boy?
Gally is suddenly not sure he does want to hear it.
Stay strong. Don't show him your fear,
he thinks. So he gives a hurried nod.
Yes, sir.
Your life is now in my hands.
As if to demonstrate, he holds out a papery hand. His fingers make his hand look like an overturned spider. From nearby, a scattering of sand from where Gally had been sitting lifts off the ground, floating like a serpent made of particulate matter. The coiling sand floats to the middle of the man's hand and hovers there until it collapses, forming a small pile in the center of his palm. Gally gasps as the man closes his fist over it.
Your preference in this regard matters greatly. I could end your life, and I would not blame you, being a young boy living in such a brutal wasteland as Jakku. Many on that world crave the luxury of death. I have felt their collective desire, just as I can feel the cowardice that prevents them from fulfilling that desire. Or would you like to hear the second choice?
Another quick nod from the boy.
The second choice is, I give you a new life, a better one. I give you a task that, if you manage, will lead you to greater things. Not something so mundane as a job, but a role, a purpose. I sense in you potential, a destiny. Most people have no destiny.
He says this last sentence as if it disgusts him, as if those without a role to play in his game are just obstacles in the way, piles of junk to be gone around.
They are useless. They are not actors on the stage, but just props. Just decorations to be moved around, painted, knocked over. Do you know opera? No, of course you don't. But we can fix that if you accept from me this new life. Will you, boy? Will you take the easy way, the road that leads to a quiet, immediate death? Or will you change your fortune, here and now? Will you accept a new life?
The choice is no choice at all. Gally knows death well. Jakku is death. Already at his young age, the boy has seen many corpses out there in the dirt and the dust. Skin gone tight and shiny like leather. Hair gone brittle like the mane of a thistermount, one of the stump-legged riding beasts the anchorites ride. Death is a favor to many on Jakku. But the boy has never sought it. Not even in his darkest moments. At least he has not sought it for himself. He says,
I want a new life. I don't want to be me anymore.
The man hums. Good. Then I have your first task, young Gally. You will go back to Jakku, the spot there in the dirt where my droids were operating is precious. Not just to me, but to the galaxy at large.
He sweeps his decrepit hand as if to the greater universe.
It is significant. It was significant 1,000 years ago, and it will be significant again. You'll go back there, and you'll monitor my droids excavating the ground. Then I will send more droids, and they will build something there below the ground. I want you to guard this space. Can you do that?
Guard it? I'm just a boy.
Yes, but a resourceful boy, I wager.
I am resourceful.
He doesn't know if that's true, but what good is saying the opposite?
I will guard it.
Good. Keep others away. Do not let them taint this. Lead them astray. Kill them if you must. Can you do that? Of course you can. The better question is, will you do that?
I will.
Then we may have a future together. For now, you go back. Go home. We will meet again one day.
Thank you. I don't know your name, sir.
A small smile.
We can be on a first-name basis, you and I. Gally, my name is Sheev. We will be friends. An emperor must have friends, after all.
This is Mark Thompson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Star Wars Aftermath Life Debt, Book 2 of the Aftermath Trilogy by Chuck Wendig. This program was directed by Kevin Thompson, executive producer Aaron Blank. Star Wars Aftermath is a production of Lucasfilm Limited and registered or trademarked where indicated. Copyright 2016. All rights reserved. Used under authorization. Music composed by John Williams. Music publishing by Warner Tamerlane Publishing Corporation and Bantha Music. Music Master Production Copyright 2007. Lucasfilm Limited. This has been a Penguin Random House audio presentation. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.